Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
It takes real effort to assess and write up contractor performance, and a poor or incomplete performance assessment report doesn't do anyone much good. The Defense Inspector General took a look at 48 such reports prepared by the Air Force, and it found some weaknesses. For more, we turn to Michael Rourke, the Assistant Defense IG for Contractor Management. Mr. Rourke, great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start by explaining the importance of these particular reports, these PARs, performance assessment reports. What do they look at, and who uses them?
Well, performance assessment reports are important because they provide source selection officials with information on contractors' past performance. So these are used by source selection officials across the government to assess how contractors have done in the past.
So not just contracting officers, but everyone on a source selection panel, for example.
Correct.
Who prepares these reports, and how often do they do it?
Well, contracting officers prepare assessment reports either annually or at the end of a contract, and they're prepared by the contracting officer.
So these are mainly used for the next time around that particular company might bid and on a contract?
Correct. It's used more or less as a report card to assess how well the contractor is performing, and it's done on an annual basis or at the end of the contract just to wrap up how that performance went on that contract.
Tell us about this report. What did you look at, and what did you find?
Well, we visited and contacted four Air Force commands, Air Force Lifecycle Management Center, Air Force Air Combat Command, the 338th Specialized Contracting Squadron, and Space and Missile Systems Center. And we reviewed 48 PARs that had a contract value of about $2.4 billion.
So these were not trivial deals that you were looking at?
No, these were a substantial amount of contracts that we reviewed for the Air Force, and I think it gave us a broad perspective of how well Air Force officials were complying with this requirement to evaluate contractor performance.
What were they doing wrong? Were they submitting reports that were incomplete, or did they not follow some other regulation concerning these reports, or did they just not file them at all?
Well, we had two main problems that we identified in the Air Force of the 48 PARs that we reviewed. First, assessors did not prepare seven of those 48 PARs within the required 120-day timeline. So basically, there's a period of time after the year or after the end of the period of performance where the officials would need to go in and conduct that assessment, and they did not do that in seven of 48 cases. The second problem that we identified was that Air Force officials did not prepare sufficient written narratives to justify the ratings that were given for 37 of 48 PARs.
So they said, in other words, good, bad, not so good, excellent, but without really the narratives that would help the next contracting officer understand why.
That's correct, yeah. The intent behind PARs is to provide a rating and then also provide a written description of the performance that was conducted as well, so that the next person who comes along to review that information would have a true picture of what the contractor's performance was.
How long are these reports? How detailed are they? Do they have different aspects of a given contractor's performance in a contract where they might be good, say, on technology, bad on people management, that kind of thing?
Well, there are requirements in the FAR as to what should be assessed. So that's not something that the contracting officer would just make up. I mean, they have certain requirements in the FAR that they have to evaluate. So that is set across the board.
What are your recommendations?
We recommended that the Air Force commands that we visited develop improved procedures for preparing PARs on time within the 120-day requirement. We also recommended that the assessors or the contracting officials who actually prepare these reports take either training or refresher training on how to write PARs. And we also made recommendations on registering contracts, which is more or less just ensuring that the system is set up in a way that will enable us to conduct the evaluation.
Were you a little surprised that they were not all that forthcoming or complete, these PARs, because they were written by people who themselves depend on PARs that other people write?
What I would say is that this is the second report in a series. Prior to looking at the Air Force, we looked at the Navy as well, and we issued that report on May 1st, 2015. And in that report, we found that the Navy faced similar challenges. For example, 42 of the 81 PARs that we reviewed in the Navy report were late as well. And then similarly in the Navy report, about 61 of 81 PARs that we reviewed did not have sufficient written narrative to justify the rating. So the results are somewhat similar to the Navy report that we issued a few months prior to the Air Force.
Sounds like there might be a training issue here.
Correct. And in the Navy report, we also had recommendations on training. And so that seems to be a common theme in both the Navy and the Air Force report.
And what about the Army? Have you looked at them, or are they next up?
Right now, we are in the middle of our audit on the Army. And so we anticipate issuing that report later in 2016. And I think it will be interesting to see as we continue on in this series to identify those common threads. And then oftentimes what we do when we do a series like this on each of the services and the defense agencies is at the end we prepare a summary report, which kind of summarizes and captures the common threads that are identified in each of the individual reports, so that if there are larger recommendations which need to be made to the department, we can do it through that venue.
These PARs, are they exclusive to the Defense Department, or do civilian agencies have a similar mechanism?
No, it is a government-wide reporting tool for contractor performance. So PARs are prepared across the board, and then the system which captures the PARs, known as CPARs, or the Contractor Performance Assessment Reporting System, is a government-wide reporting tool. So that is something that is across the board, not just in DOD, and it is meant to be used by everyone in the contracting community.
And what's the reaction so far from the Air Force and the Navy?
So far, the reaction has been good. I think we have had discussions with our audit clients, and we have discussed our recommendations with them on the Navy report. Obviously, that is issued in May of 2015. The Navy responded and agreed to take actions. And right now, we're in the follow-up process to just verify that they did make those actions that they said that they would take. And then in the Air Force, the report has only been out a little over a month, so we will be following up over the next few months to ensure that they carry out the actions that they told us they would do.
Michael Wark is the DOD Assistant Inspector General for Contract Management and Payments. Thanks so much for joining me.
Okay, thank you.
Read more, share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
Defense planners have lots of variables to manage in order to maintain maximum strength with the dollars they've got. Lately, they've been talking about how to modernize the forces, and that can mean nearly anything. Joining me with some brackets to help define modernization, Dakota Wood, Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation. Dakota, good to have you back.
Hey, really a pleasure to be with you again. Thanks.
So how does DOD define modernization? Do they define it in a precise way, and how is it simply distinguished from getting new capabilities?
Well, new capabilities are, you use these words like leap ahead or transformational or revolutionary, which I think have gotten kind of useless. But the idea is new things, you're looking very much downstream 15, 20 years. And so research and development, what DARPA might be kicking out, those sorts of things. Modernization blends into that, but I think it's more of a near-term perspective. You know that you have an aircraft that's getting ready to end its lifespan with flight hours, or maybe a submarine that's reactor's core, or it's the number of times it's dived to deep depths. You've got an end of lifespan. Vehicles are the same way. And so you know that you need to replace an existing capability with whatever that next generation is. So modernization really is making more modern something that is rapidly becoming antiquated.
And DOD at this moment has quite a lot of things there that by that definition are due for modernizing.
You know, if you look at tactical aircraft within the Air Force, the existing primary fleet, F-16s, F-15s, it's used up about 80% of its usable life, hence the urgency to get the replacement item, right now it's the F-35, on board. So that would be a modernization effort. If you looked at new capabilities, and you start talking like Gen 6, you know, what's the after F-22, F-35 airplane? So we're already thinking about that, but that's, you know, that's 20 years down the road. So aircraft modernization, really key. The nuclear infrastructure, Weapons design is another big thing. And I think submarines is probably a good element to think about, kind of a triangle there. So SSBNX, the replacement for the ballistic missile submarines, which will be coming to the end of their life in the 2020s. What's the follow-on to that? Big price tags, but it's something that you can predict.
I guess I didn't realize submarines do have a limit on the number of times they can deep dive and how long they can operate. Then they just, what happens, the metal gets weak and it's time to just scrap them?
So I had a friend of mine explain this great. It's, you know, when an airplane goes up to extreme altitude, you're changing one atmosphere. A submarine going underwater could be 10 times that, you know, when you start to think about the crushing depths of water, 10 times or more. So the metal hull is compressed, and then it expands, compresses, and expands, and it fatigues over time. And then you have the reactor core. So this thing is emitting a lot of radioactive particles, and a containment vessel can only absorb so much of that, then it becomes brittle. So that has a fixed lifespan as well. So submarines have a very easily to define and measure lifespan, and when it gets to the end, it's not like you can put in a new transmission or, you know, re-weld panels or something like that. That's done, and you can't extend it, so you have to replace the entire boat.
And, of course, the nuclear, the submarine fleet leads to the nuclear question, and that debate is just starting to really heat up, I think, with respect to how the nuclear weapons themselves are to be modernized or replaced, or what's the story there? Because is presuming that's still part of the doctrine to have that triad, a lot of those weapons are quite old.
As you see proliferation around the world, you know, more actors joining the nuclear club, you know, the increased importance of a strong, credible nuclear deterrent still has continued relevance. You know, we've left the Cold War, but this idea of people with deep nuclear inventories still exists. So you have to have that. And based on self-imposed restrictions, we haven't done any new design work in decades. We haven't done any testing, you know, active testing in over a quarter century. So the thought is that the intellectual capability, designs, innovations, you know, what new out there might be possible, we haven't really explored that. Meanwhile, you've got other entities like North Korea, Russia, Iran, which is aspirational nuclear power, et cetera. They're not so constrained. And so they've been coming up with new ideas. And, you know, you don't know what you don't know until you do experimentation, research, and development. So the idea of re-energizing America's approach to nuclear weapons design use capabilities is something that's really grabbed a lot of attention. And again, it's another expensive proposition.
We're speaking with Dakota Wood, Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation. And how skillful is DOD at budgeting for modernization, and how good is it at getting on the same page or getting Congress on the same page as it with respect to what sounds like pretty important tactical questions?
Yeah, I think the second part of that is the more problematic. In terms of knowing what you need, it's an easier path. Every year, the service officials go before Congress and they say, given the basket that we've been told, you know, from the executive branch on down, right, you know, the presidential administration, this is kind of the area of spending or the budget, and then this is how we think we need to apportion that planned budget. And then you always have this unfunded requirements, you know, the wish list. If we had some more money, then these are other things that we think that we need to acquire as well. So articulating requirements is a fairly easy thing. Getting that through Congress, because Congress is dealing not only with the defense budget, but with all the other spending that goes on. Right now, the proposed defense budget is something like 15% or less of proposed federal spending for the coming year, $4.1 trillion federal budget. Of that, defense spending will be around $600 billion. So it's the congressional piece and the fighting that goes on between various philosophies and the role of government and where you want to spend those taxpayer dollars. That's the real problem right there in terms of providing adequate funding to defense modernization.
Now, the Pentagon has been pursuing or recently started pursuing something called the offset strategy. Is that a modernization type of bucket or is that something long term?
It's a long-term thing. It's a recognition that you can develop capabilities that keep you more than a step ahead of who your competitors are. And the offset piece that comes from, If my opponent has more things, it's if they have a numerical superiority, how do I offset that advantage that they have in numbers or maybe geographic positioning? And in the past, it's been with technology. So in the 50s and the 60s, it was a nuclear offset. We would use nuclear weapons in Europe vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, where they had many more forces that they could throw into the fight. As you got into the 80s, and you had advanced computers, networking technologies, precision-guided munitions, this networked battle force, you know, tying in satellites and all the rest, was a way to offset an opponent's numerical advantage. So as we get into today and the proliferation of modern technologies and the ability to acquire those advanced technologies at a lower cost makes it easier for others to get almost get up to our level. So this third offset is viewed how do you exploit unmanned systems, robotics, big data mining and processing? You know, can you use modern things more effectively and more innovatively than your opponent to maintain that advantage? So they're looking, you know, 15, 20 years down the road and trying to exploit what commercial industry is doing and make that relevant to a military use in defense of U.S. interests.
Now, as other nations build carriers, say, for the first time, or new carriers for the first time in a long time, and submarines and new airplanes and this kind of thing, perhaps those may not be as capable as our platforms. But if ours are much older, then by definition, the opponents or even the allies are more modern because they're new in their life cycle, correct?
Older and fewer. So, you know, we've got a shrinking force. If you get into a fight and you're actually going to take some combat losses, or if you want to be in many places around the world, that really has an impact on capacity, your ability to do that. So if you've got China has a carrier out building a second one, they've got a technology or a capability in waiting. Actually making that usable. You know, how do you actually use that in an operational setting to project military power? That takes a long time to really get good at. But you can't ignore it. I mean, it's another thing that a battle commander in that region would have to account for. Just like putting guided weapons, cruise missiles on fishing boats and trawlers and other small coastal combatants, you can take these new technologies and spread them out across the force, and it really complicates the offense, defense, calculations that American commanders have to account for.
And in the short term, given the budget situation and the kind of tug and pull between the military and the administration, with an administration changing, should the next crew come in and decide to take a different military strategy, it would be a couple of years before the dollars could really be reflected, and then they could start this modernizing at a higher pace than they're doing it now.
Right, the dollars are really the limiting factor. I hate to keep going back to the checkbook, but the money is what enables you to have modern stuff and sufficient numbers so that it's militarily meaningful in any kind of operational setting. What we're seeing now in testimony before the Senate and the House as we get into this budgeting cycle is a lot of tales of woe. I mean, the Army had 45 brigade combat teams in 2012, so just a few years ago. They're now down to 31, and only a third of those, so only about 10 or so, are at acceptable levels of readiness. So we've seen a huge decline in readiness across the force. The Air Force would want to fly upwards of 200 hours a year per pilot. You drop below 150 and you're just completely combat ineffective. And I've heard reports of pilots flying only 8 or 9 hours a month, which is less than 100 hours per year. So you've got this huge decline in readiness, aging equipment, smaller numbers, so you're using it up more rapidly, so further aging, and it's going to take more money than what anybody is really thinking about at the moment. I'm projecting the need is actually around the $700+ billion per year.
Dakota Wood is Senior Research Fellow for the Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.